Hello and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast by Bruegel. My name is Conor Brummel and today we're bringing you an episode on the importance of multilingualism and languages in the European Union. Today I'm joined by Merle Laut, head of the Estonian unit of DG Interpretation for the European Commission, Margo Sis, the head of the Dutch unit in the DG Interpretation for the European Commission, and Aisin MacRory, head of the Irish Translations unit of the European Commission. Thank you for joining me. You're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
On today's episode, we'll highlight the benefits of multilingualism and multiculturalism in the European Union. For those not in the know, and as a recap for those who are, there are 24 official working languages of the EU. All documents must be translated into the 24 languages of the EU, and lawmakers have the right to speak in one of those official languages with the support from interpreters. We'll get into the technicalities of translation and interpretation a little later in the podcast and talk about why it is so important for democracy. But first, starting off, I think it would be really cool if you all introduced yourselves in your native languages for the podcast. Aisin, do you want to start?
Hey, Dom, kinche. It's Misha Aisin MacRory. I'm Tommy Gubber in Archer of Astrakhan and Commission Orpi. I'm Tommy Gannis Arkindinahin at Astrakhan.
Good. It's Margo.
Hallo iedereen, mijn naam is Margo Sijs. Ik werk sinds 2011 voor de Europese Commissie als tolk en sinds 2021 als het hoofd van de Nederlandse tolkenafdeling. Heel blij hier te zijn vandaag.
Tere, minä olen Merje Laht, ma olen Eesti tõlkeüksuse juht Euroopa Komisjonis ja töötan tõlkina aastast 2004.
Thank you so much, that was really cool, just to kind of start that off. But first, yes, starting off the podcast today, I'd like to start off talking to Merje about Estonian and the experts that we have in the room about their own languages, which you just heard a taste of. Firstly, Merje, I'd like to talk about Estonia and its kind of history within the EU and maybe beforehand. We talked briefly before the podcast about, you know, the Soviet Union and kind of the history of Estonia. But Estonia joined the EU in 2004, but before this, from 1940 to 1999, Estonia was, of course, part of the Soviet Union. And Russian was a dominant language within the country. What did it mean for the Estonian language to maybe join the European project and receive official recognition? And was it a difficult transition for Estonia?
Okay, first I have to correct you because it was not until 1999, but Estonia regained its independence in 1991 from the Soviet Union. And it's very important to stress that it was not a new country, but we had been occupied. We consider it an occupation. So Estonia first became independent in 1918 from the Russian Empire, by the way, at the same time as Finland, also from the Russian Empire. Then we had Soviet occupation and then we regained and we restored our independence. That's very important. Another important factor is that, yes, Russian was very important at that time during the occupation. But I wouldn't say that it was dominant. I would still say that Estonian was the official language of Estonia. I studied at school in Estonian, so the language of tuition in schools was Estonian. We spoke Estonian everywhere with the public authorities, even if you were required to study Russian and you were supposed to be able to communicate in Russian with the authorities. But let's say for Estonians, Russian has always been a foreign language. So sometimes people think that everything was in Russian during the Soviet occupation. This is not true, okay? Estonian was the official language of Estonia even during the occupation. What has changed with the EU? I wouldn't say a lot has changed for Estonian as a language, but what we do stress very often from the EU official side is that the translators and interpreters in the EU very much work for Estonians. So we are not just EU interpreters or translators. We are there for Estonian citizens to be able to read everything, to have access to laws in their native language. And the Estonian authorities do admit that that the EU institutions and particularly the translation services, I have to say, do a lot for the terminology. So that we actually have done a lot to develop the terminology in Estonian. in anything that has to do with the areas where the EU legislates.
Okay, yeah. Very interesting. That was kind of one of my questions that I was going to ask. Secondly, was maybe about the misconceptions surrounding Estonian, and I think you just answered it there. But I think it's really interesting to touch on in translation and the terminology and kind of the question of languages evolving and, you know, getting that interpretation and translation. And I think especially for translations, because the European Commission and the European Union in general has a massive database of documents and legal terminology. And I think I'll quickly go to you, Aisling, to talk about that. You know, how important is translation for the preservation of languages, kind of preserving what's there, and how can we expand on that and improve on that?
Well, it is very important, and I can echo what you said about Estonian for Irish as well. Obviously, there were and there are areas of expertise that hadn't really been developed in the Irish language, and translation has helped a lot in that area. We were always developing new terms. We're working with terminologies. We work with terminologists and the terminology board in Ireland itself. So that's a big plus that's come out of having Irish as an official language in the EU. But also, even just on a more basic level, having the status of official language in the EU is a big thing for a smaller language to have that that status on an international scale. Does a lot to promote the language at home as well and nationally. What the service that the EU provides in Irish in some ways goes beyond what's provided in Ireland itself, which also can help to, I think, show the authorities in Ireland what can be done and to maybe pressure to provide services that aren't provided to the same level in Ireland. So for Irish, I think it has been very important.
Yeah, I definitely think it's been a positive thing. And I suppose being Irish myself, I quite understand the kind of history of Ireland and the history of the Irish language. And there's also kind of that political question there. Obviously, we were under British occupation of the British Empire for nearly 800 years, and the language and heritage kind of suffered a lot because of that. And just to give a statistic, basically, according to the 1851 census, the total number of Irish speakers had declined by just over 1.5 million since the start of the Great Irish Famine, which started in 1845. And then by the end of the 19th century, the number of Irish speakers had actually declined to 600,000, which is, you know, when we had millions of speakers, that was obviously a very pressing issue, and obviously it was very tragic. But if we skip forward to modern day Ireland, there's kind of a success story surrounding the Irish language that you just touched upon. In the last census, around 1.8 million people, or 40% of the population, have indicated that they can actually speak Irish. So it does seem to be on the rise. Obviously, Ireland joined the EU in 1973, but the Irish language did not become an official language till 2007. The Irish language itself didn't get official working status until 2022. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that came about?
Yes, well, you already mentioned Ireland already joined the EU in 73, but at that stage, the Irish government decided that they wouldn't ask for official status for Irish, although Irish was one of the two official languages of Ireland, obviously. So Ireland was given a treaty status, like a special status at that time, which meant that only the treaties were translated into Irish, which, as everybody knows, small part of everything that's translated into the official languages. Then in the air, sort of a campaign that came from the Irish-speaking community to put pressure to ask for official status for Irish in the EU. That came really from the Irish-speaking community. The Irish government asked for that status and it was granted. It's something that has to be granted unanimously by the councils, but with a special derogation. This wasn't something that was completely new because it had been the case for Maltese when Maltese became an official language as well, because it was recognised that we didn't have sufficient numbers of qualified people to do the work that was needed to implement, you know, full official status. So there was a derogation of 5 years initially, which was extended several times, but eventually in 2017 there was laid down a timetable for really phasing out this derogation. And as of the end of 2021, so first of January, then 2022, Ireland had official status on the same level as other languages. So it was officially an official language as of 2007, but with this derogation, which meant that we didn't translate everything. We didn't provide the full language service that the other languages provided until 2022. Now we have a full team of translators, same as all the other languages. We translate everything that's translated into all other official languages.
Maybe just a follow-up on that as well. Can you maybe talk about, you know, the skills gap, or maybe there might be a skills gap with the Irish language, and how that was kind of filled in those 15 years of the derogation?
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a lot of work done by the EU institutions and by the authorities in Ireland to make sure that there would be a sufficient number of qualified people to do the work that's necessary, you know, to have this language regime. It's kind of a little bit of a vicious circle, which we found at the time. If the jobs and the opportunities aren't there, people will not train to take up the jobs and the opportunities. So we had to have the official status, and then we had to have a timetable to end the derogation to really encourage people to take on the training. You know, it's to become a linguist, you have to train. You have to, especially my interpreting colleagues will know that, you know, there's very specific training that you have to do for some of these positions. So once we had that end date, then we were able to put real plans into place. The Irish government invested in university courses, a series of translation and interpreting courses, in internships. We had big outreach programs, visiting universities, schools, promoting the opportunities and multilingualism in general. And we still do that in DGT, DG Translation has field officers, for example, in all of the member states, whose job it is to promote multilingualism, to promote opportunities, if there are job opportunities and employment possibilities for future generations.
Cool. It's really interesting in the work, obviously. I think it could be labelled as a success story in some regards over the last number of years. You touched on there, Aisling, about how Ireland has two official languages within the EU. We have English and we have Irish. But an interesting fact is that Dutch is actually an official language of more than one country within the EU. So Margo, I want to talk to you and ask you about the Netherlands and Belgium. And can you talk to us a little bit about the differences for both sets of Dutch speakers, the Flemish and then the Dutch, and how that works?
Yeah, thank you very much for this question. Indeed, Dutch is an official language in two member states, like you mentioned, in Belgium and in the Netherlands, just as is the case for French, for example, even and in France and in Luxembourg. In the Netherlands, we have 18 million inhabitants, so 18 million Dutch speakers. And in Belgium, as you probably know, we have a wide variety of official languages, at least three, French, Dutch and German. So we are around 11 million Belgians, and I would say that roughly 6 million of them are Dutch speaking or Flemish speaking. So the official language is Dutch, but we also talk about Flemish to distinguish the version of Dutch being spoken in the north of Belgium. And I could actually say that we share the same language with the Dutch being spoken in the Netherlands, but there are some slight differences. The way we pronounce the language, so the accent is a bit different, and also some expressions that would differ between the Netherlands and Flanders, or the Dutch-speaking part of Belgium. I think if you want to make a comparison, we could compare it to English being spoken in the United Kingdom or in Ireland, and then the English being spoken in the States, in America, which is also the same language, but still you can always recognize from which part of the world the person will come. So that's the same for Dutch. But nevertheless, I think we found a very nice solution because in the European context, because it is the same language. So also for translation and interpretation purposes, we will always speak about the Dutch interpreting unit, the Dutch translation unit. It's the same language. And in my team, for example, the interpreters, we are roughly 50-50%. So 50% Belgians, Flemish or Dutch speakers, and 50% of colleagues from the Netherlands. And it works very, very well. We obviously need to take into consideration that we have the honor of serving two different delegations in the meeting rooms, the Dutch delegation and the Belgian delegation, depending on who is speaking and representing the Belgian delegation. So we need to make sure that we use a language that is neutral and understandable for all our potential clients. So that is a bit of an awareness that we need to create, especially for newcomers, because they might not always have this feel to the language, but it's important because we want to make sure that communication is flawless and nice for everybody.
Yeah, sure. Mm.
Perhaps I could just come in there because it seems to be very similar to the case with Irish in Ireland, because we have, as Conor knows, different dialects of Irish within Ireland. But when we're working as translators and official level, we deal with standard Irish so that we were catering to all Irish speakers.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very nice comparison indeed.
For sure. Thank you for that. Yeah, it's super interesting because especially colloquially, you kind of always hear that there's such a big difference between Flemish and Dutch. So it's nice to hear that there's, you know, there's none of that really at the top level and that you have this kind of standard, and it's really cool to see. Moving on into the next part, I would like to talk about the nature of translation and interpretation and, you know, the technicalities or the processes involved with that. Mira, can you tell us a little bit about the skills needed for simultaneous interpretation, and how do people qualify to become interpreters?
So what generally is thought is that it's enough to know a language to be able to translate or interpret from it, but that is very far from the truth. Actually, knowing the language is only a precondition, and interpreting or translation is a separate skill. You need to be able to analyze the text or the message. And you have to have very, very broad background knowledge to be able to follow the message, especially in our context, which can be quite challenging. Interpreters do not specialize. So that's also a reason why you have to have very broad background knowledge. Maybe translators do, I don't know. I will not talk about translation. It's not really my area, because that's another thing. In the EU institutions, they're really separate. In DG interpretation, we only interpret, and translation is done in a different DG. So it is a different skill. And of course, you have to train for it. And in order to work for us, you need a master's degree normally to be able to work as a conference interpreter. So it's a special training, at least for a year, to be able to do simultaneous interpreting.
It's very interesting you speak about the context and the meaning and conveying that meaning, because it's such a skillful thing, and if people are misunderstood, and especially with languages, I think generally speaking, when multilingualism as a whole, when, you know, when people are speaking different languages, there is obviously there's room for being misinterpreted. And I think that's a really big thing, especially when it comes to like democracy. And I read a study recently about how people need to understand each other to communicate. That's clear. And obviously with the institutions, we've been kind of moving towards English as the language of commerce, if that's how you want to put it, or the lingua franca, moving away maybe from French to English. I'm just interested to hear your thoughts, Margot, on that. And are we kind of pushing away this idea of multilingualism and moving towards monolingualism? Is there a cost involved with that?
When you talk about English as a lingua franca, if I can put it that way, indeed, obviously, I think it's something which is not limited to our sector or our context here in the European bubble, if I can call it that way. Nowadays, when students go for a university course, you will always have a component of English, and people are learning the language, and obviously, people working for ministries or at high level, the delegates that we meet, they're all normally quite skilled in English. However, I find it interesting how you phrased it. Does it come with a cost? Because indeed, I am convinced that it can, in some circumstances, really come at a cost, in the sense that what we do and what Mary explained as well, and also what the translator colleagues do, we don't do it just because out of politics or policy reasons. We do it especially to make sure that the European citizen has access to our debates, but also to make sure that member states can send to Brussels, to the negotiating table, those experts that are fully expert in their domain. As you all know, the wide variety of topics being dealt with here in Brussels is quite important, is quite impressive, from customs to food safety and justice and so on and so on. So it's important that member states can send the experts in that specific domain who are not necessarily polyglots or language experts. We are there for them to help them to make sure that they can get their message across. And I would even there to say that at the top level, people that have really a very good understanding and an active knowledge of English should maybe consider when they make the language choice, when switching on the mic in a meeting, if for that specific purpose in that specific meeting, English is going to be helpful or not. Because even if you're very trained in that language, then still you will have less vocabulary at your disposal than when you're speaking your native language. If you're in a negotiation, you want to make sure that you're convincing, that you have a wide variety of words and arguments and nuances and expressions that you can use. If it gets very technical, and God knows it does in our meetings sometimes, you also want to make sure that you have the right words, the right jargon to use. And you don't want to give a competitive advantage to a real native speaker, for example, regardless of the fact if you choose English or French or German or whatever other language. So I think those are things that you need to take in consideration. It's also more tiring when you express yourself in a non-native language than in your own language. And then there is a little bit, I would say as well, the political side to the use of languages. I mean, every language is equal, on an equal footing, regardless of the fact if it's being spoken by 60 million or by 6 million or 600,000, as you put it in your introduction. And I think it's important that we share and that we cherish these languages. Yeah.
On that, is there pressure for people to speak their mother tongue or their native language? Because I know, for example, there's been calls for Irish officials who work in the European level to have fluent Irish, but obviously not all of them do. Do you experience that maybe in with Estonian or with Dutch for people who are working officials in parliament or in government to speak Estonian and Dutch?
I know that in some countries, like France, for example, there's an official policy that French officials always speak French, even if they know English very well. As far as I know, there is no such policy in Estonia. We don't make it a political issue to speak Estonian. I mean, what I see is that, of course, people more and more prefer to communicate in English because they would like to speak to each other directly instead of going through somebody else. But what Margot just said, everything is really valid because, as I said, for us, our native language is still Estonian. It has always been there, and any other language is a foreign language where your vocabulary is limited. But I'd like to touch upon another aspect, which is not so much in what language you speak, but what language you listen to when you're in a meeting. Because what I see with our clients now is that, of course, they all understand English, but they still prefer to listen to Estonian because they would have to report back in Estonia in Estonian. So they have to write memos or what they heard in a meeting, or they have to consult with other ministries, and that would be in the Estonian language. And they actually prefer to hear all the terminology and the words they need to use in their language. And another aspect is that if more than one language is spoken in a meeting, let's say it's a wide language regime and the French speak French and the Germans speak German, then you would have to listen to interpretation anyway. And if you have to listen to interpretation, you prefer to listen to it in your native language rather than in a foreign language because it's easier to follow. So that tendency that I see now, that interpretation is not only there because people do not understand so much, let's say, English or another foreign language, but they need to keep up their Estonian, which is also becoming an issue with the predominance of English, all the documents being in English. As you know, English is everywhere. But if you work as an official for the Estonian government, you still need to know all your terminology in Estonian too. So we come in handy there.
No, it's very interesting, and for sure. And I think you touched on it already with skills and, you know, needing to have skills and a master's and stuff like that. But is there requirements around language levels and how many languages you need to speak to become an interpreter? Margot, maybe if you want to take that, you're nodding there.
Okay. Well, I cannot give you, unfortunately, one size fits all answer because it would depend on the native language. So I can speak about what are the requirements for people with Dutch native language, but I know for a fact that Maria's requirements will be different for the Estonian booth. We now, in the Dutch booth, for example, require candidates to have at least two foreign languages on top of their native language. And one of them, surprisingly, needs to be English. So we want English to be part of the package, and then you can have any second other language in order to take part in our accreditation test. And then it depends for other booths. They might have other requirements, but I think the fact of having English in your package is a reality for many booths because it's also our reality that indeed the predominance of English in meetings is there. Also in meetings where, unfortunately, due to logistic reasons or budgetary reasons, we are not able to offer the whole wide plethora of languages, all 23, 24 in some instances, where we work with smaller regimes and some delegations will need to use another language than their own. Then, of course, often we notice that they will use English. If I can just come back to the question you asked Mary as well about this policy given by the governments about the use of the native language. I know that for the Netherlands and for Belgium, it's not really the case. We just, for example, had the Belgian presidency of the European Council. Given that it's quite a multilingual country, there's not really a strict communication or instruction about the language to be used. And I think the same goes for the Netherlands. But what we as an interpreting service obviously try to do is to raise awareness. We will never say, now you have to use your native language. So we just want to share our thoughts as communication experts, as people that are behind the window, having a look at what everything that is happening in the room, verbally, non-verbally, the dynamics and so on. And we are quite privileged observers. We're very happy about that because it's quite an honor to sit at the front row in very interesting meetings often. But it makes us also the ideal experts, I would say, to give some advice to delegates as well. We see what works. We see what doesn't work. I don't know if you're interested in those things, but for example, if people read out texts, then we really see that generally does not work. So we give tips, we raise awareness, we do coaching sessions about communicating with an impact in multilingual settings with and without interpreters. We try to take away a bit of the myths as well around interpretation. Those things, this kind of awareness raising initiatives, we really take them on us as well as part of our multilingual purpose and objective.
Just that you mentioned it there, what are some of the myths around interpretation? Do you want to kind of go into it?
Okay, but they're very practical, but you mentioned that we would maybe at some point talk a little bit about technicalities. One of the myths is that people not necessarily understand, for example, if they're speaking Dutch, why is the Dutch booth not working? Why are you not working when I'm speaking my language? Well, because it's always being translated or interpreted through the other booths. So we have lots of colleagues in all the other booths who went through the effort and the pain, maybe, of learning my language. We are quite privileged because the institutions are here in Belgium and lots of colleagues want to integrate. So they went through the effort of learning Dutch. So when Dutch is being spoken, it will be interpreted, translated directly from or by the French colleague, by the Italian colleague, even Lithuanian, Estonian, lots of exotic languages, colleagues with exotic languages that went through the effort of learning Dutch. So that is one of the myths. We always work into our own native language, normally, classically. There are exceptions, but that's the base scenario.
That's maybe something I forgot to mention, that the most important skill for an one of the most important skills is knowing your native language very, very well. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, and you're nodding there. Do you have some thoughts, Ashley?
Yeah, no, exactly the same for translation. And I think that a lot of people, when they hear that someone's a translator, they assume that they speak 10 languages and that they're working in all of those languages. But the reality in the EU institutions is generally, especially for translators in the Commission, you translate into your main language from one or two other languages. So often you have excellent translators who speak three languages tops, you know. So it's really the main thing is to be completely fluent in your main language.
Okay, interesting. Is there any kind of myths around translations or requirements that you need to have a certain number of languages?
Well, I suppose one of them would be that you need to have like 10 languages, which isn't the case. Another one is that we're interpreters.
Yeah.
So usually you tell someone in Ireland that you are a translator for the EU and they imagine that you're sitting in the booth with the whole thing. They've got you down as Nicole Kidman. But that is it.
Oh, we are. You can't see us, but we all look like her.
You are. Me, not so much. But yeah, for translate, we work on written texts. We're not translating the spoken word. So it is quite different. And obviously the basic linguistic skills that are necessary are the same, but the other skills are very different, really. You know, it's for me, it's not obvious at all that someone that is a good translator is necessarily a good interpreter, or even vice versa. So yeah, they are different jobs. And like I was already said, they're dealt with completely separately within the institutions as well. The institutions have their own interpreting services and translation services.
Interesting. No, that is very interesting. And I think because we talked a lot about English, I just wanted to maybe touch on with you, Aisling, as well. Obviously, Ireland does have two official languages, one of them being English. And also Malta has English and Maltese. I wanted to ask, you know, does this raise some eyebrows? Do people look at Irish and Maltese people and say, you know, you have an advantage because that you have the English language natively? Or is this kind of, you know, a myth as well surrounding languages within the EU?
I would say probably yes. One thing I would say is that generally in Europe, in Brussels, my dealings here, it's very positive. You know, the general feeling is very positive that we have our other native language. We have our native language that's represented as well. And I was pleasantly surprised. Any negative sort of feedback or feelings I've got would have been more so from people in Ireland, to be honest. I've never come across any. People are generally here, I find, really interested in languages, really interested in what is that language that I've never heard before, in the oranges of languages. You know, they see it as a really positive thing to have. And I think it's one of the most positive things about the European project is that respect of different cultures and different languages. And it's kind of one of the, you know, the shining stars of the project in a way, how multilingualism is dealt with within the EU. No language is more officially important than any other language. You know, each language is given the same respect and the same, the same amount of attention, you could say, as other languages, which is something that is really positive. And for as an Irish speaker, it's quite inspiring to work in that environment, to know that your language, even though, you know, a smaller language in terms of number of speakers, is given the same respect and the same status as other languages.
No, yeah, I think that's, yeah, you've summed it up very nicely there, and thank you so much. Just coming to the end of the podcast, I think I want to grab just your final thoughts about multilingualism and multiculturalism in the EU. And I think a nice way of wrapping that up would be to ask you, like, why you were so inspired to get into your field of work, interpretation and translations, and, you know, why you believe in the European project and languages, and the importance of languages for democracy. So maybe if we'll start with you, Maria.
I would just like to continue where you stopped, Aisling. One aspect that I didn't touch upon when I talked about skills and interpreter's job is intercultural communication. I think interpreters are also cultural mediators. Mm. And even if everybody speaks, I'm sorry, but sometimes bad English in meetings now, my English colleagues sometimes call it globish. I mean, they all come from their different background, and that's maybe an added value of the interpreter, that when we interpret in meetings, we know where the French person is coming from when they say this. So it's not really interpreting words. The skill is very much understanding what is behind the words, what is meant, And that's very, very exciting and very interesting. And I really think that's a huge richness in Europe that we have all these languages. And with language comes also culture. So it's much wider than just the words and just the language. And I think it's important for the European project that people in every member state would have access to legislation and the deliberations in their native language. And that's paramount. And I'm thrilled to be part of it and give my little contribution. And I really believe in that, actually.
It's really nice. Mario, do you have similar thoughts?
Yeah, for me, the European project is all about what the slogan actually says, United in Diversity, right? So we want to come together to create projects to find common solutions, but we stay authentic to ourselves. And I think if you want to come together, and you're so many, and we probably might even become more at one point, you need to be able to understand each other. And to understand someone, you understand him or her a lot better if you understand his or her language. Because like Maria said, you understand where the person comes from, you understand the culture, the people, even the food, even the way they look at sports, the way everything which is important in the country. And that if you understand the other person better, you will understand as well what this other person needs in order to come to a compromise. And that is what we do every day in the European project, finding compromise to get somewhere together, to make progress. And for me personally, that has always been something very intriguing and inspiring and humbling as well, to be able to be part of that and contribute very practically, trying to make sure that this communication goes very smoothless. And if you want to know my moment when I knew in life that I would become an interpreter, just a small anecdote, I was still very small. I was 12 years old on holidays with my parents in France. And of course, in Belgium, we learn French from a quite young age. So I was able to already speak a bit of French. And there were some teenagers, 16 years old, and a French boy who was desperately in love with a Dutch girl. And he came to see me and he said, I need your help because she's leaving soon and I want to write her a letter. And I also would like to have a chat with her. Can you come over? Can you help me? So I translated the letter and I helped with the chat. And then I explained all of that to my parents. Yeah. And they said, but you know, those are actually real jobs. You know, the translating, that's what a translator does. And the chatting, that's what an interpreter does. You can make money out of that later when you're a grown-up. So I went back to the French boy and I said, you still owe me something. And that's when I thought, this is what I want to do in life. Yeah. And here we are.
That's amazing. I love how animated you got there. You were so excited. Your eyes just lit up. And that's a really nice story. It's really cool.
Flashback.
Ashley, do you have any final thoughts?
Well, I can only echo what my colleagues have already said. I mean, for me, it's really, you know, it's one of the founding principles of the EU, multilingualism, and rightly so. You know, I think it's really one of the big reasons that it works, that we can all understand each other and communicate with each other. But for me personally, on a personal level, I didn't dream as a child of being a translator, I have to admit. but I always knew that I wanted to, I studied Irish university, that I wanted to work with the Irish language. And I remember when I was in university, going on, you know, marches for that were asking for the status in the EU. And I didn't at the time think, oh, I want this status because I want a job in the EU. But it's brilliant that people that want to work with Irish at a high level have the opportunity to do so abroad as well. You know, I love my life here. I love the chance to work with in a multicultural, multilingual environment, which is something that often people that speak minority languages don't have the opportunity to do. So it was the EU project that gave me the opportunity to do that. So I'm very, very grateful.
Thank you. That was very interesting. And generally, thank you to all of the guests and the experts today on the podcast. It's been really great and relevating. You know, for myself, it's been a fantastic insight. So thank you so much for joining me. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.